Kids today grow up with a wave of chemicals never experienced by any human generation before. From the exhaust pipes, from their own car seats, from all sorts of chemicals in the food, pesticides around them. How bad is it? Well, let's find out what the scientists know from Dr. Philip Landergan in a lecture given to the Harvard Medical School in February 2006 entitled Children's Chemical Burden. This is part two of two.
With regard to the male reproductive disorders, I don't know what's causing them. There's been speculation that it's chemicals, synthetic chemicals like phthalates, bisphenol A, that have the capacity to disrupt endocrine signaling, and that may be true. There's a researcher at the University of Rochester who rumor has it gave a talk on this campus at 1:30 this afternoon named Shauna Swan, who's done some very interesting work looking at prenatal exposure to that class of chemicals and reproductive anomalies in baby boys. And I think the evidence is starting to come in, but it's still early days. There's a great deal of information from the animal literature, the literature on wild species like seagulls and frogs, on the impact of endocrine disrupting chemicals on reproductive development. But the human database is minute. And then I mentioned that we have good data on chemicals and brain development. Howard has told you about all these chemicals. Well, he's told you about the first two. PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, which are a chemical that used to be used in electrical equipment, class of chemicals that are extremely persistent in the environment, class of chemicals that contaminate the Hudson River for 200 miles, contaminate New Bedford Harbor. It's been found that, and the Great Lakes, it's been found that moms who eat fish contaminated with PCBs produce babies of diminished intelligence. And the data are just starting to come in on pesticides and brain development, but it's not surprising that pesticides would cause brain problems in kids because they're chemicals that were deliberately created to be neurotoxic, and that's how they kill mosquitoes too. And we now know, and Howard certainly spoke to this in his recounting of Herb Needleman's work a few minutes ago, we understand now that neurotoxicity is much more than obvious stuff like coma and convulsions. It includes learning disabilities. It includes shortening of attention span. It includes dyslexia and school failure. And I'd like to show you a pair of slides that I got from Herb Needleman that explain how widespread low-grade neurotoxicity can screw up a whole society. So this is the distribution of IQ in a normal population. And IQ is intelligence quotient, is scored from 0 to 200. And except in Lake Wobegon, the norm is 100. And it's a bell-shaped curve. Standard deviation is 15 points. And in a hypothetical population of 100 million children, 6 million will be mentally retarded, which is to say that they have an IQ below 70, and 6 million will be gifted with an IQ north of 130. And that's what happens when there's no toxins floating about. But if something comes in, like lead, and it's widely dispersed in the society the way it was in this country when we were putting lead in gasoline, and if there's enough lead to knock the IQ down by just 5 points on the average, which sounds trivial, this is the impact. And Howard spoke to this too. It reduces by more than half the number of gifted children. It increases by 50%, more than 50% the number of retarded children. That puts a huge burden on society. Special ed, diminished lifetime productivity in these kids because they're just not as smart. And you can even think about national security issues. How do you run a vibrant economy in a good, safe country if this many people are walking around with less talent than they should have? It's not a healthy situation. And Howard spoke to this a little bit, the notion that early exposure may cause later disease. He showed us the data on the relationship between lead exposure and dementia. There's also some fascinating data on Parkinson's disease and environmental chemicals. It's a new area of inquiry. It's just coming to light. It begins with the recognition that rates of Parkinson's disease have been going up rather dramatically in this country for the last 25 or 30 years. The second piece of evidence was something that happened about 25 years ago now in San Francisco, where else, where a group of young guys cooked up a chemical called MPTP, which they thought would be a good cheap substitute for heroin, get them high, and they took it, and I don't know if it made them high or not, but a bunch of them woke up the next morning shaking with Parkinson's disease, which they continued to have for the rest of their lives, because the chemical just wiped out the cells in the substantia nigra, the area of the brain that's affected in Parkinson's disease. And it also turned out to be, the MPTP story was actually more complex than that, because some of them got sick immediately. Others were okay for 5 or 10 or 15 years, but then as they got older and as the normal attrition occurred in the number of neurons, it happens in all of us, we're not as smart today as we were at 21. As the normal neuronal attrition occurred, apparently the number of functioning cells in the substantia nigra fell to below some threshold that's needed for normal function, and then the Parkinson's disease appeared. And most recently, there's some animal data from rats that exposure of newborn rats to pesticides, especially paraquat and mancozeb, can lead to Parkinson's disease when the rats are still rather young adults. We pulled together a symposium on this subject a couple of years ago down in New York City, and it was published in Environmental Health Perspectives, if any of you wish to read further. I think it's very cool and kind of scary stuff as I get older. We've done some cost analyses. Part of me hates to do cost analyses, but when you're dealing with the people that run Congress, it's actually very effective to be able to tell them how much disease costs. And the reason it becomes effective and necessary is that the polluting industry will know to the dime what it's going to cost to control mercury emissions or what it's going to cost them to stop making some neurotoxic chemical, and they'll go down to Washington and they'll whine about job loss and moving factories to Malaysia. It becomes our responsibility to explain to the Congress that the cost of pollution can be measured in dollars as well as in human misery. And this is very persuasive. It's persuasive in Washington. It's persuasive when I go to the state capitol up in Albany and argue for state resources to deal with environmental disease in kids. Makes an impact. So what about solutions? I promised I would speak to solutions, and I shall. Need to have a multi-pronged attack. First of all, we've got to test chemicals for their toxicity. We've got to track diseases. We don't even know how many new cases of attention deficit disorder or autism occur in this country each year. It's only kind of a guess as to how many occur. We're good on cancer, we're good on measles, but we're terrible on most chronic diseases. Research, better training, got to do a better job of caring for patients, and we got to prevent. So let me say a few words about each of those, give you some targets. So in the case of toxicity testing, the current approach is not working. We actually have a law in this country. It's called the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA. It was passed by the Congress in 1977 over the vigorous objections of the chemical industry, who did not want to test chemicals. But the law as it's written is a pretty good piece of legislation. The problem is that the law was barely passed, and the chemical industry got their hands on the regulations that were written by EPA pursuant to the law. The law simply creates a legal framework, and then the EPA needs to write the actual regs that specify what shall be done. And they basically emasculated the legislation in the regulatory process. And so the way it works is this. Suppose Dow Chemical wants to bring a new product to market, and they've done some playing in the lab, and they find that this molecule makes wood twice as hard, that it's really very effective as a wood preservative, and will have a great market, especially in the South where there's a lot of dampness and wood is rotting all the time. And they test it in 4 rats to make sure it doesn't kill the rats instantly, and it doesn't. And so they then file a piece of paper, it's actually a volume of paper, with EPA called a pre-manufacturing notice, a PMN, and they inform EPA that they intend to produce 8 million pounds of this stuff per year for wood preservation, and that they have done toxicology testing and they see no adverse effects. And you'd think that EPA would say, well, you only tested it on 4 rats. But the problem is this, is that each year EPA gets 1,000 of these notices into an office that has about 6 people. So how many of those pre-manufacturing notices, some of which will run 4,000 pages in length, how many do you think get good scrutiny? Not a whole lot. And so the chemical gets blessed, it's released, and it's out there, and if 4 years later it's found to produce birth defects, well, first, the birth defects have to be recognized by an astute clinician. Secondly, somebody has to tie the birth defect to the exposure. Thirdly, if you think about the way diagnoses work, the birth defect will probably get picked up if it's something bizarre, like babies born without limbs, as happened in the case of thalidomide. But suppose the birth defect is a 3-point reduction in the IQ of the population. It might take 40 years to get picked up because nobody's paying attention, nobody's testing chemicals for neurotoxicity. Or suppose the toxic effect is a reduction, suppose the chemical is immunotoxic and it produces a reduction in lymphocytes so that children's bodies are no longer very effectively able to detect cells within the body that are going malignant, what's called internal cancer surveillance. So that this immunotoxin is out there, it's all over the land, and its toxic effects don't become manifest until 40 years later when there's increased number of lymphoma, and then people worry where the lymphoma is coming from. And so the problem is that we're being very, very foolish in the way we release chemicals to the environment without testing. We're basically relying on non-existent surveillance programs to pick up the toxic effects of chemicals that we're not testing in the lab where we should be testing them. Well, several groups have finally become aware of this problem. In Europe, there's a program called REACH, which has been debated currently in the European Parliament, which would impose much stricter rules on chemical testing. It's being fought very, very vigorously by the folks in Finland, the Nokia company, who make cell phones, because they're worried about finding something. In this country, Senators Lautenberg of New Jersey and Jim Jeffords from Vermont have proposed something called the Child Safe Chemicals Act. Probably won't pass in this Congress and probably would not get signed into law by this president. But part of what one does in Washington, if you have a good idea, you try it out, it gets shot down the first time and perhaps even the second and the third time, you refine the legislation, you sharpen it, you hold hearings, you get input from a lot of people, and we may see better legislation come along in a couple of years, let's hope. With regard to disease tracking, I've already mentioned that we don't do a very good job of tracking chronic disease in this country. One thing we have gotten rather good at is that for about the past 6 or 7 years, CDC has done population-based surveys, the whole U.S., measuring levels of chemicals in blood. The analytical chemistry has become incredibly sophisticated. They can take 10 or 20 cc's of blood from an arm vein and test it for almost 200 chemicals now. It's just remarkable. I used to take 15 cc's to measure blood lead. And they have been documenting that hundreds of chemicals are present in the bodies of most Americans. Typically, the highest levels are found in children because of children's heavier exposures, kilogram per kilogram. This is very important for tracking things, like PCBs are coming down, but polybrominated diphenyl ethers, class of chemical that's used as fire retardants, in computer casings are going up. Nobody really knows what their toxicity is, but at least we know that they're going up, and that's the first step towards enlightenment. And we have begun finally in the past 7 or 8 years to look seriously at on the research front, the impact of chemicals on kids' health. We now have a network of children's environmental health centers. Howard is the director of the center here at Harvard, which is focusing mostly on Nettles. Just making sure you're awake. The test of your short-term memory. Who spoke just now? What did he speak about? We're looking at developmental disorders and endocrine disruptors in our center, the center at New Jersey, and also one in California. We're looking at autism. And actually, important research findings are coming out. And for example, the two centers in New York, ours and Columbia's, documented that babies who are exposed in utero to the organophosphate pesticide chlorpyrifos were born with small heads. Not a good thing if you want to go to Harvard to have a small head at birth. And as soon as EPA restricted residential use of that pesticide, the epidemic of small-headed babies went away. So that's a good thing. One of the most important things that's happened in the last 5 years is we have decided to launch something called the National Children's Study, and I'll tell you a bit about that because I think it's just an extraordinarily exciting event. What the National Children's Study is going to be is a study that follows 100,000 children from conception at least till 18 or 21 years of age. And the way it'll work is that moms will be recruited early in pregnancy. In fact, the hope is to recruit 25% of them before they conceive pregnancy, which is a heroic undertaking because you have to ask an awful lot of young women if they're thinking about becoming pregnant in order to capture that number at the moment they actually conceive. And we'll take samples of blood and urine and hair from these women at several points, 3 points during the pregnancy. We'll take DNA from the moms by buccal swab. When the babies are born, we'll get blood from the baby to measure what chemicals are in cord blood. We'll put the mothers and the families through very extensive questionnaires to find out about the social environment, the school environment, the community, the neighborhood in which they live, occupational exposures. And we'll track the kids. And the goal is quite simply to find out what influences in the environment broadly defined, what are the environmental influences that influence growth and development and risk of disease in kids. How many of you all know about the Framingham Heart Study? About two-thirds, okay. Well, Framingham is, of course, a town west of here. I know it is a town that's 11 miles east of Hopkinton. And in 1948, right after World War II, rates of heart disease and stroke were just skyrocketing in this country, absolutely skyrocketing. And people at this institution and at the U.S. Public Health Service had some hypotheses as to why. They thought cigarette smoking might have something to do with it. They worried about cholesterol, they worried about high blood pressure, but they didn't really know. And in order to learn about the preventable risk factors for heart disease and stroke, they decided that they needed to do a prospective epidemiologic study, and they picked the town of Framingham to do it in because it was sort of a nice, homogeneous town. And it was a town that had previously participated in some tuberculosis field trials, and the people out there were sort of compliant and liked working with researchers. And so the whole town was enrolled, physical exams were done, and people were followed, and correlations were established between risk factors and disease. And out of Framingham and a few other studies, like the Alameda County study in California that followed Framingham, out of these studies came pretty much all the knowledge that we now have of preventable risk factors for heart disease: smoking, cholesterol, hypertension, triglycerides, sedentary lifestyle, diabetes. Everything came from that. And the consequence has been one of the best kept secrets in American public health. Do you know what has been the percentage reduction in rates of cardiovascular disease among white men in this country as a consequence of Framingham? Has it gone down at all? Rates of cardiovascular disease among white men, not so much in blacks, have come down 50%, 50% in this country since the early 1950s. And it's all because of smoking cessation, cholesterol control, reduction of treatment, early treatment, and persistent treatment of hypertension. Amazingly well-kept secret and a huge triumph for public health. We want to do the same thing for kids through the children's study. That's the goal of the children's study. So the status of the children's study is that it's been 5 years in the planning, and just this past September of 2005, seven so-called Vanguard centers were set up around the country, places where the study will launch. We're intimately involved in one of them because the borough of Queens in New York City was selected by the feds to be one of the Vanguard sites for the study. And so all through October, November, December, January, we were actively planning the study and getting ready to take it into the field next summer. And guess what happened in early February? Our beloved president canceled it. In his budget message to the Congress, he proposed to cancel the study. Well, fortunately, the Congress is an elected body, and this is an election year, and we're fighting back, because I think it would just be a shame, just be an absolute shame, and frankly, a national scandal and a great disgrace to cancel the children's study. There's too much disease in kids that's caused by preventable environmental factors to just walk away from the study that I've termed our generation's best hope for controlling those diseases. So we're fighting back. We've raised money. We've hired what's politely called a lobbyist, who's a retired congressman, a man of high ethical principles. And we're down there chugging every week. And we won a huge vote in the Senate last week, which was the first step on the road. Now the next round is in the House of Representatives, and then eventually there'll be the signing of the budget bill sometime in the months ahead. But we won the amendment in the Senate by a vote of 73-27, with actually more Republicans voting for increased health dollars than voting against. It makes you think that maybe some of his own party are deserting the president. So we shall see. Keep watching. There was an editorial on the Globe on Monday about the children's study. These are some of the big questions that we hope the children's study will answer. And if you want to read more about it, you can go to the website. Or the simple way is just go into Google and just type National Children's Study into Google, and you'll come right to it. It's a very good website. They've done a nice job of keeping it up to date. And these are the sites that were set up. What about patient care? How many hours of education in occupational and environmental medicine do you imagine the average American medical student receives? No, it's more than two. It's three times more than two. It used to be four, and then it went up 50%. So it's now six, according to a national survey that was done a few years ago by Barry Levy, who's a guy at UMass Medical School. 6 hours. I'm not talking six credit hours. I'm talking six actual hours of training in these matters. And the result is we've done some surveys that document that practicing physicians are very uncomfortable in dealing with disease of environmental origin beyond perhaps lead and asthma. And moreover, they've got no place to refer patients to. If a mom brings a child with pesticide exposure into the pediatrician, the pediatrician is probably not going to know very much herself, and she's got no place to send the family. So it's a real issue. So we've come up with the notion that every doctor should know something about these hazards, and that moreover there should be referral centers and major teaching hospitals regionally located around the country where kids can be sent, just like we have pediatric neurologists and pediatric hematologists to whom you refer children when you have a complicated problem that falls outside of the day-to-day realm of practice. We reckon that we should have some kind of subspecialty certification in environmental pediatrics and centers of excellence. The American Academy of Pediatrics has heard this message and begun to accept it, because a lot of us have worked on them. Mike Shannon from Children's Hospital has been a leader. And they have now published a book called the Handbook on Pediatric Environmental Health, the Green Book, which they've distributed for free to all 50,000 pediatricians in this country, which is a very good thing. It means people have a reference thing on their desk now that they can turn to when a child with a problem walks in the door. Prevention is very important because knowledge for its own sake is not the goal of research in this field. The goal of the research is to find clues for prevention. And I think you can conceive of prevention as proceeding on three levels: in the home, where people are actually have the power to make decisions about what food they eat, what chemicals they use; in the community, for example, the level of the local school, and then the broader society. So here's one example of how prevention in the home can make a difference. This was a paper published in Environmental Health Perspectives by a group from the University of Washington in Seattle, and they found that families that ate organic produce had about an 85% to 90% reduction in urinary pesticide levels, a massive reduction. And here are some examples in communities. And I live in Westchester County, New York, which is just north of New York City. And one of the things that we got through in Westchester County was what's called a neighborhood notification law for pesticides, which means that before my neighbor can spray some nasty chemical on his apple tree, he's got to give me 48 hours notice so I can come up to Boston or something, chance to get out. And indeed, there's actually provisions in that if you don't want him to be spraying arsenic on his tree, there's legal redress. You can prevent him from doing it. Doesn't mean you win, but at least there's a process in place. Building sidewalks, probably the single most effective preventive measure for obesity. They've got to be safe, of course, but that's the first step. That's the hard infrastructure. Prevention depends on knowledge. Chemical industry hates to have you know what their chemicals can cause. And let me close with this. Howard already stole part of this, but I'm going to use it anyway. So he talked about lead and gasoline. Why do you think EPA made the decision in 1976 to begin the long, slow, turned out to be 20-year process of getting lead out of gasoline? Does anybody know that story? I think it was because they were concerned about kids' brains. Well, they were. I mean, everybody likes children, they're cute. But what was really going on was that a year or two before, EPA had mandated that new cars be equipped with catalytic converters to cut down on ozone and oxides of nitrogen, because air pollution, smog, was becoming a big issue, especially in places like Los Angeles. And those catalytic converters contained the metal platinum. And it soon became evident that the lead in gasoline, and pretty much all the lead that was available in those days, except Amoco for some reason. Amoco used to advertise lead-free gas even then. And the leaded gasoline poisoned the catalytic converters, knocked them out very quickly, and they became ineffective. And therefore, EPA mandated that new cars, and they mandated that new cars have platinum converters. Then they mandated that a certain percentage of the U.S. gasoline supply should be lead-free gas with an increasing percentage each year, hence the term phase down. And this was the trend, and Howard has already showed you these data of what happened between 1976 and 1980, the first 4 years of the lead phase down. And the prediction was that there would be a tiny decline in the average blood lead level from what was then a population mean of about 16 down to about 14 or 15. That was the prediction. And as Howard has already showed you, this is what actually happened. But what he didn't show you was that wasn't the end of the story, because things continued to get better in subsequent years as we got progressively more lead out of gasoline, and still more in the years after that, so that nowadays the average blood lead level in American kids is actually below 2. It's about 1.7 compared to what it was back here. So that's another great triumph for public health. I've told you about two, the conquest of heart disease and the conquest of lead poisoning. The fact that we can pull these things off once in a while is actually cause for hope. And usually these things require data as a foundation, but of course data are never enough. You need to have data plus societal will, plus somebody like Herb Needleman, who's willing to get hit about the head for advocating for this, and then finally the right administration in power and the right political moment, and things eventually happen. And that's it. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Philip Landrigan speaking at the Harvard Medical School in February 2006 on the topic Children's Chemical Burden, Part 2 of 2. You can watch the full series of lectures in streaming video at chge.med.harvard.edu/education/course_2006.